legends, and welcome to Unbeatable You, where we connect, thrive, and conquer. I'm your host, Brett Robbo, and I'm super grateful for your valuable time. So let's just dive straight in. Keep thriving and enjoy. Paul Taylor, neuroscientist, exercise physiologist, nutritionist, current PhD scholar, author of the book Death by Comfort, How to Survive and Thrive in the Modern World, and you're a podcast host of the show The Mind, Body, Brain Project. Welcome to the show, legend.
You've got the right guy.
That sounds like you. Great. We're off to a good start then. Mate, I met you recently at probably one of the best corporate events that I've ever seen put together. Yeah. And we were down in the Hunter Valley together every Monday for 4 weeks in a row for PwC. And you were one of the keynotes on the Monday morning, and then ran your workshop with the crew down there. And I saw your keynote there three and a half times, actually. I missed half of it on the first one and caught it every time since then. So, mate, I love everything that you stand for, and not just that, but how you deliver your message. So super grateful to have you here today and to share that energy and that information. And I just want to go on, kick off by asking you, because you say that you're a pracademic. So I want to know, what is a pracademic? And then also, why is it not enough for you to just implement the stuff that you learn, but you also have to go and study it and then have that degree or that level of study behind you as well? Why is that so important to you? And what the hell is a pracademic?
So mate, a pracademic is a word that I've made up, which is why most people haven't heard of it. And it is basically, so I think we've all heard really good academics who are totally into their research. They know everything about their topic, but they just cannot deliver it in an entertaining, compelling way that people can take the insights out of for themselves. So for me, a pracademic is someone who takes the academic research and then works out the practical implications of that and then delivers it in a way that makes sense to real people who don't live in the academic world, right? So I kind of consider myself a pracademic, having had a bit of a history in academia, but now somebody who runs programs and solutions for corporations and individuals. And for me, it's important to keep on the cutting edge of all of the research, so that the stuff that I'm telling people is current, and that they can then actually implement it with good effect.
And does that mean that you practically do a lot of the stuff that
That's
you
right.
learn
we've
about?
We've all seen academics who stand up there, and it's not only academics, lots of doctors and medical people who talk about stuff, talk about health, and you look at them and you go, you're not walking the talk, are you? So for me, it's that credibility piece that's really important, and being authentic is a deeply held value of mine. So if I'm going to get up on stage and talk to people about certain lifestyle practices, then I need to be living them, but by and large, most of the time. Like, nobody's perfect, but doing it most of the time, I think, is pretty key.
What are some of the most challenging practical experiences that you've put yourself through when you've come across it in the academics and thought, I've actually got to do this before I can get up and speak about it?
Yeah, well, actually, it's probably reversal. So for me, I talk a lot about resilience and stress inoculation and, going through combat survival and resistance to interrogation training in 1998 was pretty full on. It was 10 days of pretty hardcore stuff that they are no longer allowed to do to people because of health and safety, but right. They kind of got away with it back in those old days. And it was 10 days of every stressor imaginable in the winter in the UK, no sleeping bags, getting thrashed physically every single day. The only food they gave us was a chicken between four people, and it was alive when we got it. And that was for an entire 10 days. I reckon we one chicken between four people. Yeah, and it was alive. Yes.
And it was live. And wow. I need to, did you have resources to start a fire and cook it?
Or we did. So what happened is everybody had a little tobacco tin and you were allowed to take whatever you could put into that tobacco tin other than money. So, you know,
take from the chicken.
No, take with us to survival course, right? So, so we had, a makeshift little saw, a flint, you know, those things that fire starters, which is absolutely critical. So yeah, that's how we started the fire, but obviously you got to gather up everything and stuff like that. So yes, it was alive. We had to give it the old, I don't know if I should go into this, how we actually killed the chicken, but
we can join the dots here.
It was alive and it wasn't. Then we had to pluck it. Then we had to cook it, share it between four people. Right. And I'll tell you what,
like hunter and gatherer is always
every little best last bit of that chicken was eaten. I can tell you there was no waste going on there. But anyway, so we did 5 days, you know, prepping and 5 days escaping evasion. We were hunted by a hunter force. And then when we thought it was all over, we got introduced to the shock of capture, give it a bit of a tickle, hooded, sensory deprivation. And then we got taken to a place and we got interrogated for about 12 or so hours. And when we weren't getting interrogated, we were in stress positions the whole time. And they are horrible. And we had white noise playing at the volume you'd hear music in a nightclub. And actually still to this day, I remember, I walked past the bathroom about half an hour ago and my wife had left the fan on. And it's just when a fan is on, it just puts me on edge just that little bit. And then I turn the fan off. I'm like, oh, how good is that?
What's a
stress positions? There's a whole heap of them. I don't know if you saw some of the images come out of Abu Ghraib, but it's a position that you put somebody in that is really, really stressful physically and then psychologically, and you leave them there for long periods of time. So one would be if you were to stand up and put your hands against the wall, but take a big step back so that you're leaning against the wall and having to support yourself. Like after a minute, you know, it's a little bit taxing, but after 5-10 minutes, it's horrible, horrible. And then when you can't endure it anymore, you get a bit of a whack and put in another stress position. So they are aptly named, those stress positions. I don't really want to revisit those ones again. But it was after that experience that I kind of discovered a couple of weeks later, something happened to me that would normally have been quite stressful. And it was just like water off a duck's back. And then again, something a few days later. And then I thought, actually, I think this is just like exercise. And I'd already had done a master's in exercise science before I joined. So I understood exercise really well from the perspective that it is a stressor. And that stressor is a stimulus to create adaptation. And it's from the stress of exercise followed by recovery that we get bigger, faster, stronger. And that's when I thought, well, maybe emotional and psychological stress works the same way. So I started asking people who were on course with me, and they all said the same thing. Stuff that used to stress them out was no longer stressful. And that's what in the military, it's termed stress inoculation training. Right. And it kind of does what it says on the tin. You get inoculated, you get exposed to a big dose of stress so that it actually builds your capacity to deal with further stress.
Is it then a choice, though, that it doesn't stress, like that other things don't stress you out? Because as you say that, I think about the modern day exposures that people still choose to be triggered by modern day stresses, and it still is stressful for them.
So there's so much under the hood here, right? So but part of it, and what I'm talking about there is what a lot of psychologists will not mention. They talk a lot about psychological flexibility, hugely, hugely important, right? Self-care, self-compassion, all important. However, if you're going to go through really stressful times, all of that stuff, it will get you so far, but it's not going to help you through real stress. You know, that's where you need to have had some lived experience. And there's a lot of research around this now that you know, and it comes from the science of hormesis. That which does not kill us makes us stronger. Brackets, as long as we recover effectively and the stressor wasn't too intense or too prolonged, right? So it's that short to moderate exposure to lower moderate levels of stress, which then stimulate adaptation. And you can just align it to exercise. You know, you can overdo the exercise and it's no good for you. You can underdo it and it's not going to give the same thing. But for me, there is some of that biology that comes from being exposed to stress and the activation of these stress response proteins that are in our body. That really helps. And then, you know, to get back to your question, when we talk about psychological stress, how you choose to view and deal with that potential stressor is hugely, hugely important. So I think having gone through prior stress gives you a capacity and a belief that you can actually overcome, both of which are really, really important in deciding how that potential stressor is going to impact you, right? So if we are both exposed to the same stressor, and I have a belief or a mindset that this is really, really stressful, this is a threat to me, whereas you have a challenge mindset, we know that different parts of our stress response system are going to be activated. You're going to activate your fight or flight response, which is adaptive. I'm going to be all in the HPA axis, which is all cortisol, which can be really, really negative, right? So how you choose to view that stressor, whether it's challenge or threat, is really, really important in the outset. And then the belief that I have around my ability to deal with that is also important as well, right? So viewing it as a challenge and thinking that I have the resources to deal with it actually means there'll be a lot less cortisol released than if I view it as a threat and that I maybe don't have the capacity to deal with it. So straight away, the physiological response is different.
And is that choice, does that have to be as we are experiencing that challenge or going into the challenge?
A lot of it comes from going into it, from your psychological state of it. So look, it depends how much time you have to prepare for the event, right? But if this is something that you know is about to happen, then that psychological preparation is hugely, hugely important. But then something can just happen straight away with no notice whatsoever, and you're just in the middle of it. And then you're into, can I cope with this thing, right? So having some of that prior knowledge that it's coming can help you to mentally prepare and get in the right frame of mind for it.
I love that. And knowing what you were saying then, just that mindset shift. So what a mindset is, what we're thinking about, can actually trigger different neurochemical or physiological or hormonal process within
us. And it's very cool, right? And it's hugely important when we think about our ability to deal with stress. So a lot of stuff since the pandemic, you know, everybody's a bloody resilience expert, right? But a lot of that stuff has been reactive and how do you bounce back whenever you've been harmed or damaged by stress, whereas I like to get on the front foot and actively build your capacity to deal with stress and train your mindset as well for when you do encounter stress, because it's going to happen to everybody, right? And we're all going to get a shit sandwich to eat from the universe. Some people get an unfair share. And the Stoic philosopher Epictetus said that we should not enter into things lightly for which we have not prepared. He said, we all need to do a hard winter's training. And he was talking about life. He wasn't talking about battle. And he was using it as an analogy for life, that we need to prepare for the challenges that life is going to throw up to us. And I find that today, what some people are trying to do is sanitize the world and remove potential stressors. And a lot of parents, well-intentioned, try to do this for their kids and try to remove them of stressors. And you're actually doing them a disservice.
What are some common stressors that we can choose to bring into our life that are supportive for us to thrive? Your book is about thriving in the modern world. What are some ways that we can set ourselves up through implementing stressors?
So for me, this is hormesis training, right? And the foundational one for me really is around exercise, because exercise, it does so much stuff, right? Apart from enhancing your capacity to deal with stress, which we'll get into in a second, exercise controls our gene expression. So it creates all the conditions necessary for the brain to be high performing, right? So the brain controls everything that the body does, but it is completely dependent on the health of the body to function well. So for me, if you're not exercising, you're actually depriving your brain of the neurotransmitters that are some of the neurotransmitters that it needs to function well. So it's foundational in that respect, in that it prepares your brain to be a high performance machine. But then when you're exercising, and particularly doing more vigorous exercise, you're actually training your stress response system globally. Right. So there is evidence that people who are fit and active have a lower cortisol response to a 30-minute stress battery, psychological stress battery, than people who are unfit or inactive. So the unfit people get much more stressed by an independent stressor. And I think the reason is because every time you're exercising, you're training, not only are you training your ability to handle the stress of exercise, whether it's running or lifting weights or whatever, but you're globally training that stress response system, right? And what we know about the stress response system is it's really important for it to get activated quickly, but then to switch off afterwards, which is really, really important, right? And a lot of anxious people, their stress response system gets activated very quickly, but it doesn't switch off and it stays switched on. So that training of activation shutdown is really, really important.
Can you give us a practical example of that fact that what those studies showed that fit or active people can handle a stressor more than inactive? What would be a practical example there if you had an active person and an inactive person exposed to like a certain type of stressor, and then you were to measure? So what would a practical, like a maybe an everyday type example of that?
So one of the things, so they use this MSRP stress test, so it's 30 minutes. So it would be like counting backwards from 200 in sevens, right? So if you start to count that out in sevens, and so if you just start now, and
do it out loud. In my head. So I got 200.
Hurry up, Robert. Not quick enough. Hurry up. Come on, come on.
180.
Come on, faster, faster, faster. So you see the way that I'm harassing you right now is you're trying to think, and as you're trying to think about something complex, I'm harassing you, I'm activating your amygdala, and that's making it more difficult for you to think, right? So that's one example. Public speaking is another example. So they do this in this 30-minute battery. So it's a whole range of known psychological stressors. And people who are fit have a much lower cortisol response than the people who are unfit, right?
Gotcha. So someone who's less active and or very inactive and unfit beside me, they might be able to do that -7 much quicker, and they might get the results.
No. They wouldn't do it quicker because they don't have the ability to handle the stress, right?
No, but what I was getting at is they might actually be better at actually calculating that. So they might be able to get the results, but then you test the stress response and here I was not doing real well, but I don't have as much stress going through. Like if you ask me how
that's
feel,
right. So calm, look,
but the other that person
test
might
does
be
rely on mathematics ability as well, right? So
what I was getting at is
that's right. But you know, they do this whole stress battery, which is a number of independent stressors, so they account for all of that, and the difference is absolutely phenomenal, right? And you know what, this is just stuff that the military have observed over the last 1,000 years. Like, the British Royal Navy have been training soldiers for more than 1,000 years, and they have noticed that fitter soldiers seem to be able to handle more psychological and emotional stress. And that's why a lot of military training, particularly basic training, a lot of it is physical as well as psychological, but it's that physical fitness, because they know that you're battle hardened. You know, you've heard of that term, it's battle hardened. And that's going through stress followed by recovery is what actually toughens us up. And it's just like that athlete model of training. You know, you've got to do the work and then recover, and then you increase your capacity to deal with it, right?
Brilliant. Love that. So, and there's obviously a lot of the health factors that go into that as well, is because I was going to ask you, what are some of the other pillars? But obviously exercise is a key pillar in helping us thrive, not just by the handling stress, but the multitude of unarguable health benefits that exercise brings.
Yes, it's got a multitude of health benefits that just make your whole body, brain, entity function better. I don't like that distinction. You know, it's we're integrated. We're completely integrated beings. And so if you want to have a high performing brain, you need to be physically fit. There's just no two ways about it. And there may be people listening going, hey, I've got a pretty good brain here, but I don't do a lot of exercise. And my response to them is, yes, but how much better would you be if you did exercise, right? Because exercise controls gene expression. It creates the building blocks for neuroplasticity in the brain, the ability to adapt and become better. So it is really fundamental. And then there are other deliberate exposures to stress, such as cold stress and heat stress, that activate the same stress response pathways that exercise does. But part of it, Robbo, as well, is it's not just the physiology of when I do exercise or have a cold shower or cold plunge or get in a sauna. It's not just the physiological response. That's important. But it's also the psychology. And it's also this mindset of getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. Like Epictetus said, we must undergo a hard winter's training. You know, it was that idea of getting comfortable with being uncomfortable, because then when you're challenged, you feel more able to rise to meet those demands. And that is really, really important in the outcome. Is my belief that I can control this. It's called a locus of control.
Before I ask you what the other pillars are of this book, why was it important for you to write this book about how to thrive in the modern world? What's come up for you through all your research, not just being the pracademic, but also the academics, and what's showing up in our current society that is alarming, that we need to learn how to thrive in this
world?
We are
the most overweight, most depressed, most medicated, and most addicted cohort of individuals that there's ever been. Yet life has never been so good. That's basically what drove me to write this book. We have it easier than all of our ancestors, yet we are going through what can only be described as a physical and mental health crisis. Right now, 1 in 5 Australians has a mental illness, and it's getting worse, and it's worse with our kids. Prevalence of mental illness in this country is at about 50%, which means statistically 1 in 2 of the listeners will develop a mental illness at some stage in their life. And we know that right now, 1 in 2 Australians is living with a chronic disease. That's not 1 in 2 older adults, that's 1 in 2 Australians. And when you hit my age north of 50, it's the norm to be living with multiple chronic diseases. Yet we've never had it so good. So clearly something is wrong with modern life. And we can't, so we have a hunter-gatherer's genome that is living in the modern world. One of my favorite quotes is from Professor Frank Booth in the Journal of Applied Physiology 2012. And he says, the human genome has not changed in over 45,000 years. The current human genome requires and expects us to be highly physically active for normal functioning. Note the way he didn't say optimal, he said normal functioning. So most people get that exercise boosts your mood, but what they don't quite get is if you're not highly physically active, you're depriving your brain of the neurotransmitters that it needs to function normally, right? And then you throw in eating a shit diet on top of that, right? Having lack of sleep, that lack of social contact. All of these things are really important for our biology, and we're just not doing them because of modern world. So my view is that we are ancient bodies and brains in this modern world, and the gene expression, there has not been changes in the genome to compensate for that.
Yeah, it's crazy. I've actually used that terminology since seeing your keynote. So thank you for sharing that on from Dr. Frank Booth as well, because I think that brings a really good picture into people's lives of, oh, right, okay. So when we're surrounded by 5G towers and social media and toxins on our food and other environmental toxins and fucking concrete grounds and you know, tall buildings and all of this kind of stuff that we put this 45,000-year-old genome into, it's no fucking wonder that we have so many
challenges.
And then
when we eat shit food and we don't move and we have crap sleep hygiene and practices, it all compounds, right? That's the key thing.
And isn't it crazy that when things get more stressful and busier, it's the, oh, I don't have time to exercise, I'll just go for that fast food. And I'll put off sleep because I need to get more shit done. And they're probably the three key pillars that are actually going to be what you need to put focus on.
And people just think,
on.
I just need to run harder. So I can't exercise now, and I just need to run harder. You know, in a few weeks, I'll be able to get out of this, and they just don't. But what they don't realize is that by not exercising, it's a fool's trade-off. Yes, you get more time because you're not exercising, but your cognitive performance drops if you're not exercising. So you're nowhere near as effective. And I always say to people, the time that you tell me that I don't have time to exercise, that is when you need to make time to exercise. It's not just that, but also make time to make your diet good, to make your sleep hygiene practices good, you know, to do that recovery. And by the way, recovery is not putting your feet up and watching Netflix with a bottle of wine or a six pack in your hands, right? It's doing the foundational stuff becomes more important when you're in the thick of it, right? But that's when people get stressed and all that stuff goes out the window. And, you know, often then they've had a hard day and they just want to relax and they drink alcohol or eat shit food, which in both cases then impacts upon their sleep. And then if you have poor sleep, you got more stress hormones the next day. Ghrelin is higher, so you're going to eat more. And because cortisol is higher, it's going to be more crap food. Leptin is lower, and that means you're much more likely to sit on your arse and less likely to exercise. Then you're less able to handle the stress of the next day. And then you're more likely to come home and eat crap food and drink alcohol, and it's Groundhog Day, right?
And so that's what you're talking about there is, I was going to actually ask that, but you kind of answered it, is why is it easier for us as humans to make poor decisions when we're already feeling shit? And why is it easier for us to make better decisions when we're feeling better?
Yeah, so let's take the making poor decisions, right? So a lot of this is about your ability to exert self-control. And self-control, it's been shown, I mean, I did a recent podcast on it. It is a finite resource in the brain, right? So when if you've had a really difficult interaction or meeting at work, your willpower, your self-control becomes depleted, right? And if you're not taking a short break to recover, it's just depleted, depleted, depleted. And then you come home from work and that's your self-control is just gone, right? You come home and then you might come home and the kids are going bananas and it's like, Jesus, I just need a glass of wine to take the edge off, right? And then that glass of wine becomes two, becomes three because your self-control resources are depleted. And the other thing that happens is that your brain and my brain has worked out, and everybody's brain, they've worked out to this point how to manage stress. What's the quickest way to do it, right? And you, when you're stressed, your brain will go, I know how to sort this shit out. bring me alcohol or bring me some crappy foods, right? And it's
crappy food.
It's not that it's the crap food that it's after. It's after the response in the brain, right? So we know there are scientists all around the world working out the bliss point of certain products. So this is a certain combination of fat, salt, and sugar. And it can be any two of those three that in certain combinations activates the reward pathways in the brain. And your brain goes, oh, that shit tasted good. Give me some more of that, right? And that's that moorishness is the bliss point. So we have all of these things at our disposal that our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't have, right? So it's the fact, look, we are wired to seek comfort, particularly after stress, but our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't have the just outrageous amount of choice around comfort that we have. So it's much, much easier for us to do, right? And even if we don't have anything in the house, we just jump onto Uber Eats or something like that and it's here in no time. So that's really part of the issue, is the whole setup of this modern world, from the fact that we are working too many hours, that we're not socially interacting, we're not moving as much, we're eating shit food, but also that it's stacked up against us in that there are comfort options everywhere and it's really easy to take the easy path out.
Yeah, I often say when I drive past the bus stop and there's a sign for Macca's or Hungry Jack's and it's 1995, feed a family of five and you all get a hamburger and chips and Coke and fucking probably dessert as well. And I often say to my wife, I understand why people make those decisions regularly. Absolutely. Like, I get it. It's so easy. It's like an easy, it's handed to us. But what you're saying there is in actually saying no to that is developing the strength and this skill that can actually leverage other areas of our life as well. So it's not just about don't choose the shitty food because it's bad for you in so many ways, which people know, but they'll still make a choice anyway. Well, actually, not everyone knows. But in the understanding that in other challenging areas of your life, when you can start to say no to that, even with that urge, then you're exercising that willpower, which can serve you in other areas of your life.
Absolutely correct. And that's really important. It's like a muscle in that you train it, it gets stronger. You don't use it, you lose it. And that has been shown. It has been shown that obese individuals and drug addicts, the area for willpower in their brain, that is much smaller in volume than people who are healthy and who are active. And it's actually been shown that when unfit, unhealthy, or unfit, inactive people maintain an exercise program for 6 months, the areas of their brain that are responsible for willpower and self-control grow in volume. So we can see that there is a training effect, and so exercise becomes a gateway behavior. So it becomes a gateway to be able to do other things. And we see that all the time in psychology experiments, that if people have been exercising for a period of time, normally 6 months or more, then they might tweak their diet or they might get off the cigarettes or reduce their alcohol consumption. A lot of people think it's a self-concept thing. Neuroscience will tell you it's just purely a brain-based thing, that they have built those networks in the brain. And sorry, Rob, one little thing on this that's really important. I can't remember who did the research, but whenever you do something that is good, whether it is exerting your self-control or a particular habit, that you should reflect on it for about 12 seconds to really encode it into memory. So, you know, if you say, no, I'm not going to have the Hungry Jacks or the McDonald's, whatever, I'm going to choose the healthy choice, is when you're eating that, think, fucking awesome. How good was that? You know, I exerted my self-control there and that is bloody awesome. I'm one step closer. Just that little thing is going to encode that better into your brain. So that little self-reflection piece is really important.
Is that dopamine?
There's a number of different chemicals. One of them would be dopamine, which is about goal-directed behavior and motivation. But it is also driving the actual consolidation of memory in there as well.
Mm. I love this because one thing that I notice that comes up for people though with a lot of the people that I coach is teaching them that philosophy, but it's hard for them because they have ingrained in them, and especially Aussie blokes, to not credit themselves for doing good things, either out of guilt or the kind of tall poppy syndrome. I don't know if Ireland's the same.
I don't know what is wrong with Australia and this frigging tall poppy syndrome. I mean, you go to America, it's like the opposite, right, of tall poppy syndrome.
They talk themselves up and give them a pat on the back.
There's lots wrong with American society, but they are very good at supporting people and that backing people who do well, right, and giving them lots of accolades. And you know, I think this tall poppy syndrome, it's just gone too far. I'm all for a bit of humility, but I think the tall poppy syndrome has just gone too far.
Yeah, and I also think that that's definitely changing, and there's different groups where it's more prevalent than others, but that's definitely a common thing that still comes up. We've mentioned nutrition there a few times. What's, based on all of your research in academics and the pracademics, what do you believe is... It's such a confusing world out there. If people say what's healthy, what's not, what do you believe is a good kind of foundation or viewpoint or perspective for us to have to be able to make healthy choices consistently?
It's very, very simple, Robbo, and it doesn't matter whether you are paleo, low-fat, high-carb, high-fat, low-carb, vegan, vegetarian, carnivore, it doesn't matter. There is one rule that I have that applies across all of them, and it's to eat a low HI diet, where HI stands for human interference. Basically, when you're looking at a piece of food, you need to ask yourself, has this been alive recently and been minimally interfered with by humans? Has it grown out of the ground, off a bush, off a tree, swam, run around on four legs, and been minimally interfered with by humans? If that's the case, eat it. Don't worry about the bloody fat, the carbs, the protein. That's the worst focus that we ever did. But it's like if you're looking at a piece of food and you're going, Mr. Krispy Kreme donut, I don't remember seeing you running around on four legs, then it's in your treat food, right? So I use that low HI with the 80-20 rule. So roughly 80% of stuff that goes into your mouth on a daily basis should have been alive recently and minimally interfered with by humans. General quick practical guide, shop around the outside of the supermarket. Most of this shit is in the middle. And just note that, listeners, the next time you're in the supermarket, and you'll see how true that actually is.
Supermarkets are crazy for that. I heard someone say a while ago, or might have seen it written, if there's a small health food section of the supermarket, what is the rest of the
sections? That's right. And look, a lot of health foods, it's horse shit. They've got a health halo, right? So,
exactly.
And don't even get me started on the Australian star system, because that is complete rubbish. Basically, if your grandmother would not recognize it or eat it, be suspicious about it. Just eat real food. That's the key. Most of the stuff that goes in your mouth should be real food.
But it's so time consuming, and I'm a busy person, and I've got kids, and I'm running a business, or, you know, this is what people will say, that is it that easy to just eat real food?
And look, I see those arguments all the time. So there's a number of different arguments, right? So one is around the time. I don't have time to eat healthily. So I always say to people, do you own a television? And if they say yes, I say, is it ever turned on? And if they say yes, I say, it's not time, it's choice, right? Also, a big argument that you hear is around the cost of this stuff. And look, that we know that a lot of that this healthy food is more expensive. However, Felice Jacka from the Food and Mood Center has shown that you can eat very, very healthily on a low budget, you know, being things like frozen vegetables, which are absolutely perfectly healthy. Canned beans, canned lentils, dried beans, those sorts of things. You can bring those into your diet relatively cheaply, right? It's basically people need to think about where they're spending their time and also where they're spending their money. So in the 1960s, we spent a lot more than double the amount of our disposable income was spent on food in the 1960s compared to now. So
Hang on, more just repeat
than
that.
We spent more than double the amount of our disposable income on food in the 1960s than we do now. So people are choosing to spend their disposable income on computers, flashy TVs, other sorts of things. And there's a whole gamut of these things that we are spending our money on now rather than food. So that those arguments really don't stand up very, very well, unless, you know, there are people who are living on the poverty line. Then it's really, really difficult, right? But but all those other things ultimately come down to choice, right? And people go, well, I have to work 50, 60 hours a week on this job because, you know, I've got to pay the mortgage. And it's like, well, ultimately, that's still a choice, right? As to what house you live in and how hard that you're having to work to pay off that mortgage. So fundamentally, when it comes down to it, there are a lot of choices that actually go into this, and then we get caught in it, and then it seems like it's too hard to get out of, right? And that's where people really need to sit down and map out their future and do things like an 80-year-old self-exercise or a 90-year-old self-exercise. You fast forward into the future, you're in your 80s or your 90s, you're on your deathbed, and you're looking back on your life as if it plays out the way that it's played out currently, right? And that's important, because when you ask people, what are you going to be like in 5 years? Most people think they're going to be fitter, they're going to be healthier, they're going to be exercising more, they're going to have lots better habits, right? We have this optimism bias. So you need to do this exercise as if it plays out, life plays out. You're working the same amount, you've got the same amount of busyness, you're doing about the same exercise and stuff, and you're looking back in your life, what are you going to wish you'd done more of, and what are you going to wish you'd done less of, right? And you know what comes up all the time? I wish I'd spent less time on social media. I wish I spent less time thinking about, worrying about what people think about me. I wish I'd spent more time with friends and family. I wish I'd spent more time doing hobbies. I wish I spent less time watching TV, right? So it's when you do this honestly, it's a really, really good exercise to start to think, okay, so what little changes can I make to make a bit of room in my life to get the things that I want to get.
For people listening to this, there's a couple of things that just came up for me, and some of them were saying, well, you wouldn't understand. And I think that's what I love about you, is that you speak to the truth, not to what people want to hear. And I think there needs to be more of those kind of voices. And one thing that comes up for me too, kind of a question to you, is I feel like we're at this point in society where if it's normal, I'd be second guessing it. If you find yourself doing something that's normal, then it might need to be reviewed, because the norm these days is the takeaway foods, the inactivity, the overworking, the lots of time on social media, the less time in nature, not necessarily connecting very well with your loved ones, like the norm of what's accepted these days and what society has built around us, like what we said with technology and infrastructure and everything like that. If we find ourselves doing the norm in some capacity, maybe that can be a little bit of a little nudge, like a little brush of the feather to say, let's just check this out a little bit and see if there's anything
Look, absolutely. And let's talk about something that is quite current, right? Where they talk about, and this is where you need to tread a thin line, but if we talk about reality, so there's so much now about overweight and body shaming, and you can't say that to people. You can't say they're overweight. You can't say they're obese, all of this stuff. And we're normalizing it, right? So it is normal. Two-thirds of the country is overweight or obese. And there are a lot of voices out there talking about celebrating your body in whatever shape it is. And all of that is to make people feel better about in their own skin. And whilst there are certainly benefits to this, it's not the right message to give to people to say that this is okay. Because we know that if you're obese, you dramatically increase your risk of a whole host of chronic diseases, both physically and mentally. And the other thing is that you're going to be a massive burden on the healthcare system, right? That is just one of the realities around things, just like smokers are a massive burden on the healthcare system. So it's where is the line between not making people feel bad, but also giving people some semblance of truth and then giving them a pathway to do something about it, right? So I think we've gone too far the other way in terms of you can't criticize anybody, you can't say anything these days, to the point where people are not getting the advice that they actually need to hear, right? And I totally agree with you that lots of stuff that is now normal is particularly unhealthy, and particularly behaviors around the stuff that we see our kids do is shocking. You know, that not just the amount of time on social media, that is really, really bad, but it's what they are not doing when they're doing those things. It's the opportunity cost of all of this stuff is hugely important. So we know only 2% of teenagers in Australia meet the physical activity guidelines. 2%.
2%. Do you know what those guidelines are?
Yeah, it's 60 minutes of physical activity a day for teenagers. It's 30 minutes 5 days a week for adults. It roughly it's at 150 minutes minimum, but it's double for kids and teenagers. Most kids don't meet the minimum. 2% of teenagers. 2%. So it's what they're not doing, right? It's that opportunity cost that when they're on their screens, they're not moving. They're not seeing people face to face. They're not out exercising. There's just so much stuff that they're not doing. So it's not just the behaviors themselves. It's the opportunity cost of those behaviors that people need to factor in, both in the short term and the long term. Because if you develop obesity, or you're overweight as a kid, or you have a mental illness as a kid, you are much more likely to have that throughout your life and then have all those confounding factors.
Hence why I know that you've had Dr. Arne Rubinstein on your podcast. Brilliant. And I've had him on a couple of times and about to have him on again, heading up to his farm in a couple of days actually, and I've done his level one leadership training in Rites of Passage. And I was listening to, really, really great mentor, great human, great philosophies. It reminds me of you, where it comes, what he's teaching comes from him traveling the world and analyzing and studying these tribes and these communities in all these different countries. But I heard you say on your podcast the other day that you will, have you got one girl, one boy,
yeah.
One girl, one boy. And I can't remember if you were talking about both of them or just your son at the time, but you were saying how you would love to take him through one of Arna's camps, either the boy to man or the father-son one, which is a rite of passage. So I'm really intrigued to hear you explain why you believe it's important based on everything that you know, the values that you live, and obviously, and I know because I've heard you talk about it, we haven't really mentioned it, but what you talk about now, these values are instilled through your whole family. With your wife and kids, you do this, you live this, you breathe this, you influence this, you inspire this way of being. Why is it still important for you to take your son or daughter or both through these rites of passage?
I think whenever I interviewed Arne, I went, holy shit, that this is so, so critical. And it's because that even though the environment has changed, brain development has not changed. And when, particularly teenage boys, when they go through puberty, there are massive, massive changes in the brain. And teenage girls as well. When they go through puberty, there is a whole networks in the brain that are developing that are basically getting them, driving them to try to find their place in the world, right? And there are very well established mechanisms for doing that all around the world through these rites of passage. And it is no surprise that every culture has had those rites of passage. And, you know, this is ancient wisdom in there. And it's that connection. And actually, I'm going to get our entire soccer team, who are under 12, under 13 boys, to go on one of these camps at the end of this year. I've actually got a note to call Arne to try and organize a camp for that. And I've been talking to, I'm the assistant coach, talking to the coach, and I've been every Monday that I'm around, and I'm doing stuff with these guys. We're teaching them philosophy. We're teaching them Stoic philosophy. We're teaching them about values. We're talking to them about what are some of the stuff that actually makes them upset? What are some of the negative emotions that they got to deal with? And they're chatting to each other about working out what's in zone one, what's in zone two, what can I control, what can't I control, and doing some visualization around creating different characters, their best versions of themselves, because I think it's really important. Young boys, as they go through puberty, it is a transition to manhood, and that is the time that you need to instill values in them, that they need to do some hard work as well. They need to go through a rite of passage. They need to prepare for it mentally to have that transition into becoming a young man and being very, very clear on what are my values that I hold dear that are going to guide my behavior. When I come into conflict or when I come into situations where I could be led down a certain path, that you need these values, they become your guiding North Star. And that's why I think it's so, so important. And having all the dads there telling the stories about when they were young boys, I think that just creates that real tribe and that I think is really, really missing.
Powerful. So everything that you can instill and bring in, there's still that tribe mentality and that struggle and that support through these rites of passage that is going to actually like be icing on the cake or just coincide with
and fundamental that they really start to think about who I am and who do I want to be, you know, what sort of individual do I want to be, what sort of values do I want to have throughout my life, because if they don't do that deliberately, they just tend to pick it up from their peers and they can end up getting in, depending on who their peers are, but they just don't have a sense of direction. And I think that then goes all the way throughout life. You know, there are people who will be listening to this who are in their 50s and 60s who might think, fucking hell, I've never actually sat down and worked out what's my values, what's my purpose in life, you know, what are those guiding principles that I should use whenever I'm challenged. And I think when you do the work early and you start to build those mechanisms in, it just starts to become second nature.
Powerful, super powerful. I've spoken about it before on this show, but I envisage taking my kids, they're only 2 and 4, to through these different kind of rites of passage in different ways around the world, and not necessarily taking them to an African tribe where they've got to hunt a lion before they get accepted into adulthood, but being exposed to elders and what they would consider normal living that would be completely throwing their perspective out of whack for the normal life that we can kind of live, and not just elders but other kids and other people that can show them different ways of living and make those challenges be normal. So I love hearing it coming from you too and just seeing how it connects with all of these beliefs and philosophies that you're already instilling. On the subject of beliefs, what are some beliefs of yours that have changed over recent years based on your research or practical application in these areas?
Beliefs that have changed. Now that's a really interesting topic. I think certainly my attitude around stress has changed very, very much from, you know, growing up thinking stress is bad to now thinking that stress is actually fundamental. We need to not, and it's really interesting when you look at the literature, the academic literature, they talk about stress tolerance, discomfort tolerance, and distress tolerance. So they tend to be, one is physical, one is psychological. And I think that completely undercooks it. We don't need to be tolerating it. We need to be harvesting it, right? So it's about harvesting stress to make you stronger. You think of what you do when you harvest something, you get benefit from it. And so for me, that principle around viewing stress as something that makes us stronger, as long as we get the duration and the intensity of the exposure right, and we recover effectively. I think that is really, really key. And that's probably the one thing that I have changed my mind quite significantly on. I think the other one probably would be around contemplative practices, whether they be meditation or any of those things. I used to think, and we're talking maybe 15, 20 years ago, that it was a bit sort of fluffy. But now I just seeing the impact on the brain and the nervous system, and now the evolution of, you know, it has to be, you know, sitting down, lotus position, arming away to, well, actually just breath work. I think the power of breath work particularly has surprised me whenever you dig into the academic literature and the ability to influence massively, not just your nervous system, but other parts of the body through the breath, I think is probably something that I've changed quite significantly on. And you know, there's lots of nutritional ones. You kind of go back and forth a little bit and back and forth, and we'll continue to go back and forth because nutritional science is really, really hard to do well. And anybody who tells you that there's one diet we should all be eating is either demented, or they're trying to sell you something, or they're a member of a cult.
Classic. What do you foresee that, what's area, maybe you don't know the actual beliefs, but what do you think is an area that you might start to shift some beliefs on as you evolve more, whether it's because of technological advancements, whether it's because of you're going to do more rites of passage, whatever it might be, where do you see kind of things opening up that might shift?
I think that we will eventually shift in our workplace practices. I think there are still a number of companies out there and individuals who are still making the mistakes that sports science largely corrected 10, 20 years ago. This belief that in order to improve performance, we just need to work harder and longer. I think we are coming to a tipping point around that, that there's a realization that we need to bring in the best of sports science around measuring heart rate variability, this sort of stuff around executives and people to go, actually, I need to back off a little bit and you know, get into more of that periodized model of working. I think that's going to be a long thing because of shareholders and returning value to shareholders, which generally means profit. But that's the area that I think there's going to be a shift. Like the pandemic has pushed it in terms of working from home and that flexibility, but there's been lots of unintended consequences there as well, in that people now are not switching off, right? So we've still got a way to go on that, but I think in 10, 15 years, we might be in a lot better place.
Yeah, brilliant. As you were saying that, I was thinking my background in high-performance sport, when I got into coaching years ago and working with Olympic and Paralympic athletes, and one of the things I learned from one of the world's best coaches, I did an internship at in America, and he would look at the athletes' programs, including my athletes, and I'd take the programs over, and he'd be looking through and saying, what can we take away? What can we take away? See that 7-day plan? What can we take away from that and make that your 10 or 12-day plan? And my mind straight away went to, well, that's not enough work. But realizing and developing over time with great mentors in that space that it was not about working harder and longer, even in high-performance sport, to get results. Don't get me wrong, they work hard. However, it's that recovery piece, like what you were talking about earlier. It's that ability to execute the required task at hand and just the deliberate focus, and then taking other things off the plate to make more room for the recovery, which allows them actually
to perform.
That's
right. It's all the adaptation happened in recovery. I remember, actually, would have been more than 10 years ago, going to visit Athletes Performance, run by Mark Verstegen, and was just blown away by the personalization around athletes and the monitoring of recovery and just how scientific they were about recovery. And that's, you know, 10 years ago. You know, we are light years behind when it comes to the workplace in that respect.
Massively. Mate, mindful of your time, what I'd love to do to wrap up is the podcast is called Unbeatable You, and I've created that name over years of working with people that have overcome major challenges and adversities. And like what you said there before, that these challenges and these stresses in our life can actually be leverage points to allow us to be stronger physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, more resilient. And to be unbeatable doesn't mean that we will not be exposed to the stresses and the challenges. In actual fact, absolutely, bring it on, because as we've talked about in this podcast, is that it's an opportunity to grow and develop. However, it does take some skills, some assets, some knowledge and awareness for us to not be beaten by the challenges and the adversities that happen in life. What's one or two, and maybe you've already said them in this podcast, things that you would love to leave the listeners with for them to be able to either start designing or to implement into their lives to be able to live their own unbeatable life?
I've got a very clear one. I call it the stage and gremlin exercise. So I want people to just think about it. And I think probably everybody who's listening to this could identify a version of them that's just a little bit shit, right? And that's what I call the gremlin, right? So it's all of these negative, unhelpful thoughts and emotions, negative self-talk, victim mentality, self-criticism, all of that stuff, right? We're going to call that your gremlin. And you got to give your gremlin a name, right? And then you need to create a sage, which is the best version of you. The Stoics talked about that. So did Confucius, so did Lao Tzu, the ancient Chinese philosophers. And basically, it's identifying the character strengths of your sage. You know, what are the character strengths that you have when you're at your damn best? And if some people struggle with this, think of your best achievements in your life, your top three achievements. What characteristics or character strengths did you have to exhibit, right? So you write that list down, and then you're maybe going to give your sage one or two character strengths that you would like to have more of, right? And so here's the thing. It's recognizing when your gremlin is in control, when your gremlin's in your head. And rather than try to get rid of your gremlin, which a lot of people do, and they get into this overthinking vortex, or they get depression or anxiety, you're just going to not pay attention to it. You're going to say, gremlin, oh, there you are. Thanks for that story that you're telling me, but it's not helpful right now. So you stick your gremlin in your back pocket and you ask yourself, what would my sage do right now, right? That's a technique in psychology we call self-distancing. And it's used by every world-class athlete around the world, right? All the guys that you've worked with, they have that visualization of themselves at their best, and they have a moment where they transform into that. Now, us ordinary people can use that. And you wake up in the morning and say to yourself, who's going to get out of bed today, my gremlin or my sage? And when you went to work, who's going into work? When you're faced with challenges, who's going to front up? Your gremlin, who plays the victim, looks for somebody to blame, gets angry, gets all sort of really self-indulgent around it? Or is your sage going to front up and look for the solution? Or if there's no solution, look for the opportunity to practice a virtue or to sharpen your character. Because character comes from the ancient Greek word that means the mark of a chisel. And we don't develop character by having an easy life. We develop character by the mark of the chisel, by leaning into discomfort and doing it with the right intention and learning the benefit or practicing a virtue. That's what I think I would leave them with, is that sage and gremlin exercise, because it's so, so powerful.
So powerful. I highly recommend to everyone that's listening or watching this to just go back to that point and maybe show it to your partner.
Do it with
your
kids. Do it with your kids. It's the coolest shit you'll ever do with your kids.
Yeah, that's powerful. How old can the kids be?
Two's too young. Yeah. when they can understand a little bit of emotions, but probably the age of 4 or 5, with young kids, get them to watch the movie Inside Out. It's all Inside about out. The little emotions in the brain. And when they watch Inside Out, they just get it. So I did this when Oscar was 6 and Kira was 10. And Oscar at 6, you know what his gremlin was saying? So I got them to draw the characters. And Oscar's gremlin was called Derek. But they did speech bubbles. I didn't ask them to do speech bubble. And Derek is actually saying, I will crush the good ones and I will be the king of Oscar's head. How cool is that shit, right? Sometimes the six-year-olds are really insightful because that's what happens to us. Yeah. When your gremlin gets in your head, it crushes the good self-talk and it becomes the king of your head if you choose to pay attention to it. That's the key thing. Where are you going to place the flashlight of your attention? That, in Japanese psychology, which my wife's a practitioner in, they say is the most powerful thing in your life is the flashlight of your attention. And we choose where we place it.
So powerful. So powerful. And I guess that's why you've also made an app so that people can place their flashlight of attention in an area that's going to be supportive, and why you've written a book. So as we wrap up, where can people find you, follow you, download your app, get your book, find out more, and keep absorbing your wisdom?
So the app at the minute is just a corporate one. We watch this space. There's probably a couple of months that it's going to be public. My book is called Death by Comfort. The easy bit, if you're in Australia, is on my website, because I'll sign a copy and send it. So that's at mindbodybrain.com.au. In a couple of weeks, that will change over to paultaylor.biz, but mindbodybrain.com.au is where to go to kind of find stuff about me. And Instagram is at mindbodybrainpi.
Very good. And we will link all of that up.
Oh, and the podcast, is where they get lots of stuff. And that's the Mind, Body, Brain Project, which will, depending on when this is aired, will turn into the Paul Taylor Show.
There you go. Look at it. It's all flipping. Do you mind me asking why you're doing the rebrand?
Yeah, because I actually decided after many, many years of just winging it to go and see somebody. In fact, it was somebody who recommended that I go and see someone around taking my speaking to the next level. And her name's Julie, and she just went, you need to have, your website needs to be Paul Taylor. Get over yourself. Because I don't like, you know, the whole self-promotion. She said, just get over yourself. It needs to be done. So I'm like, I'm reluctantly being dragged into that space.
Well, it's simplicity too, right? People will remember Paul Taylor. Oh yeah, Paul Taylor.
Yeah, and if they're searching for Paul Taylor speaker, that's where it's going to come up, right? So, you know, it's one of those things that once you get over it psychologically, it makes so much sense. And you go, why not do this 10 years ago?
Well, there you go. I don't care what the podcast is called. I'm going to continue listening to it. So I recommend that all my listeners jump over. And I don't say that lightly either, just because you're on the show. I've got a lot of value from it. And I love also the pieces that you and your wife bring together around the Japanese psychology, as well as your solo episodes and the guests too. So I highly recommend that people jump over and listen to that. Mate, before we do wrap up, is there anything that you would like to ask me?
I would like to ask you, what is the biggest thing that you have learnt from interviewing guests on this program, on this podcast, that you've brought into your own life, right? Because that's one of the benefits of interviewing people, right? Is you learn so much cool shit off people. So what would you say is the one thing that you got off a podcast that you've implemented that you've gone, geez, that's been really good?
It's broad, but it's about the power of the mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the work that we do is to get out of our head and, you know, get into our heart and meditation and everything's like that. But the power of the mind, and like the stuff that you were just saying, when I hear either experts or people from lived experience or whatever it might be, and that real inspiration of the power of the mind. So it gives me huge perspective when I'm going through the little challenges, just to think about what that person went through, or Paul's philosophies, or, you know, the para athlete that, you know, can't actually do what I'm doing and here I am fucking complaining about it or something like that. So it's definitely around the power of the mind and the perspective that it's given. I was going to say optimism, but I think I've always had that within me, but it always triggers it again. Like I'm buzzing and off the back end of these kind of podcasts, and I take that energy into my relationships, whether it's the people here in the office and me and my podcast production manager, or whether it's my wife and kids or my friends or wherever I go off the back of interviews like this. So it's also that it although I know what I know and I know that I'm doing great things to be able to live a thriving life until I'm 110, I'm going to be running when I'm 110 and jumping wheelie bins when I'm at least 80, I know that it still takes consistency. Yeah. And so a lot of the things that I learn from these episodes, some things I've heard before, but I check myself and say, okay, I've heard it before, but am I actually practicing those? Am I actually implementing those? Am I fucking living true to myself and what these facts and these beliefs are?
That's cool, because it is easy to slip, right? And we need just a little reminder every now and then to get back on the horse.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, you're a legend. I want to acknowledge you for being the change that you want to see in the world in your own authentic and fun kind of way too. It was really cool to see you up on stage, not just delivering value, but I think the reason why I went back 3.5 times is because you were delivering it in a way where it was landing differently with me, although it was the same information. So I was inspired by your ability to do that, and also the fact that you are a pracademic. A pracademic in the process. So keep shining your abundant light
Thanks,
to the
mate.
World, my
Thanks,
man.
Thanks, mate, for the kind words. That was awesome, and I thoroughly enjoyed this. Keep doing your good work.
Right back at Cheers. You, legend. Thank you. There you go, another empowering episode, and thanks again for tuning in. Make sure you check out the show notes for any extra links or information that we spoke about in this episode. Don't forget you can now catch the Unbeatable You podcast on the YouTube channel, Brett Robbo Coach. If you want info and inspiration straight into your inbox on how to live an unbeatable life, you can sign up to receive weekly insights and actionable steps for optimal performance and thriving in every aspect of your life, plus first release offers on Unbeatable You courses and live events. Don't worry, there's no spam, just short, punchy, value-giving emails straight to you. Simply go to brettrobbo.com/community. If you find value in this podcast, don't forget to share it around with your mates and subscribe, rate, and review. It really supports the podcast mission massively. If you want to reach out to me personally, you can connect with me at Brett Robbo Coach on social media, and that's where you can let me know who you want to hear on the show. Keep thriving, legends, and as always, remember, if not you, then who? If not now, then when? This is your opportunity to live your unbeatable life.